Welcome to the CTO Connection podcast. I'm Peter Bell, and each week I'll be sharing an interview with a senior engineering leader. Firstly, I wanted to thank AWS, who are our exclusive ultimate partner, without whom we couldn't run the summits or the business. AWS offers a broad set of global cloud-based products to equip technology leaders to build better and more powerful solutions. Reach out to aws-cto-program@amazon.com if you're interested in learning more about their offerings. And our friends and sustaining partners at CodeClimate just upgraded their Velocity product with Team and Developer 360s, a holistic view into how your engineering org is performing with data and accurate objective metrics. CodeClimate is seeing measurable improvement, 20% plus for most customers, in feature cycle time and deploy frequency. All CTO Connection folks get a free product tour and engineering data consultation. Just mention Peter on your first call. Today, I'm speaking with Ian Wong. He's the co-founder and CTO at Opendoor. Ian, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So I was taking a little bit of time, as we often do with, I guess, to look at your background and your backstory. Looks like you really liked Stanford, like the college, like you almost couldn't leave. There's like a BS in Elec Eng, an MS, an MS in statistics, because electrical engineering wasn't enough. And then a start on a PhD in electrical engineering before you finally got put into industry. What was it that kept you compelled and engaged at Stanford for so long?
Yeah, so I grew up loving technology and I grew up loving electronics. And so I thought I wanted to be an electrical engineer until I did my first internship in my senior year, actually at a wireless communications company. And I realized I actually didn't like circuits that much. But what I really did like was the math behind EE. And I realized actually a lot of that was very transferable to machine learning, to signal processing. And so I just kind of kept studying and kept doing research. And I wanted to actually become a professor at one point. And so that's why I transitioned to get my MS in stats. And I was actually doing research with an advisor in the statistics department. But yeah, I could have been there for a very long time until I then did an internship at Facebook. And then I realized that it's kind of like in the 80s, I would imagine, where the Silicon Valley was actually leading academia in what's interesting and what's cutting edge. In many ways, in terms of data science, industry was leading academia in terms of what was most interesting and impactful. And so I decided to leave academia.
And I think that makes a lot of sense, because especially back then, Facebook was where the data was at, right? It's like, you know, there's now more trends towards open data and open government and things like that. But it was just hard to get data at that scale if you weren't working for one of the large tech companies.
Yeah, it was really interesting, where I remember in statistics, we were learning about this really esoteric thing called asymptotics, which is like, okay, you don't really know how the distribution really is, but if you like do these samples, then you can do these complicated math. And like, here's like the underlying distribution is like. And then I remember at Facebook, I just did a count star of likes for the United States of America. And I was like, oh, this is how this is how the population in the United States felt. I didn't have to do complicated math. All I had to do was issue a query to really get at how people were feeling. And it just kind of made me realize so much of statistics was really stuck in the 20th century.
Makes sense. So then you moved. I see the first couple of roles showing up here was an interface scientist at Square and then a software engineer at Prismatic.
Yeah. So the story is kind of circuitous and funny, actually. So I became a very bored and disgruntled grad student. And then I started answering all these random questions in Quora. And I got invited to a Quora user party back in 2010. And at that time, I met Keith Raboy, who just joined Square as a COO. I didn't know who Keith was. I just remember him answering all these questions about startups. I was like, hey, you're the guy who answers all these questions about, you know, how to start a business. And then I, as an icebreaker, I was like, hey, do you have a job for me? And next thing you know, I was chatting with Jack Dorsey, the CEO, and I got a job at Square. And so, you know, I joined as their first data scientist, did all things risk and fraud. And then after a few years, that was really awesome. I joined another company called Prismatic because I really wanted to build machine learning based products. But that company didn't take off. So I've seen startups that really took off and also startups that didn't realize its full potential.
And it looks like you got to play with Clojure there at Prismatic.
Yeah, that was one of the draws. I'm always a geek at heart. So Clojure and functional programming and Lisp was still has a really special place in my heart. And it was an amazing company in that it was Lisp through and through. So it was Clojure in the back end, Clojure script in the front end, and we had to build an iOS app. So what we did was we wrote all these converters to turn our Clojure files into iOS files. So we tried to stay.
So it would just emit iOS code, or like you'd emit Swift code.
Yes.
From Clojure.
At that time, it was Objective-C, but yeah.
Oh, yes. That's amazing. And it's funny because I'm going to have to ask you the question because I've got a number of friends really involved with the Clojure community. And then you even go back with like Paul Graham and his kind of startup and how his argument was, you know, that that was the language that allowed them to compete and differentiate. I think they were using Common Lisp at the time. It was pre-Clojure. Why do you think Lisps have not become more widely used in production? I mean, clearly they're being used, but why haven't they taken over the world? Any thoughts?
It's really hard to say because it really does feel like it. I think there are two things. There's the learning curve and there is productivity at scale. In terms of the learning curve, it definitely is less approachable than, say, Python or JavaScript. I think the time to first hello world or time to that first pixel you see on the screen is just longer. And because of that, it's less approachable. And maybe because the folks that are really kind of steeped in Lisp and Clojure tend to be more mathematical and more academic. And again, that could make things less approachable. And then at scale, I think you run into issues where things are so dynamic and you can modify the runtime so easily and you don't really have typed. It's not a typed language. And so at scale, I think you run into a lot of issues about being able to operate effectively within teams. So I still think that's an area that's unaddressed by a lot of the kind of the Lisp-based languages. But, you know, I haven't coded in a while in Lisp, so, you know, someone can prove me wrong.
No, and I think one of the I think countervailing opportunities is now as you see teams getting bigger and bigger, people are moving to microservices or some kind of service-oriented architecture anyway, which actually then gives the opportunity for dynamically typed languages because if you're down to two pizza teams, it then becomes, while your entire engineering infrastructure might be large, any given teams working with a tractable code base where I think you can get away better with dynamically typed languages.
Yeah, totally. And I think for us at Opendoor, we use a lot of Python now. We use TypeScript for front end, and also we use Go. And the distribution between Go and Python is actually, not a lot of people use Go, but we have some diehard Python folks in the company, and it works. I think small teams can be very productive in Python.
Well, I got to say, ever since I taught a couple of data science classes, I now have Pandas envy in every other language.
Yeah. Pandas is great. It's obviously a power tool when it comes to data science, and almost every single data scientist will need to know intimately all the APIs that Pandas offer. At the same time, it can also be very dangerous in the same way that Clojure is dangerous, in that because the data types are all data tables or just tabular format outputs, it becomes very hard to describe the shape of your data if you're not careful. And that could be a source of a ton of bugs. So it's a double-edged sword for sure.
Nice. So coming back to the engineering leadership, so you'd been a grad student, an interface scientist, and a software engineer. And then you're like, cool, now I've done that, I should go found a company and be the CTO. So what was happening and what was the thinking behind that?
Yeah, so I've always really admired entrepreneurs. My dad was an entrepreneur himself, and I thought I was going to be an academic, but I've always had a special place for folks who really are able to take something that's abstract to making something very concrete and something that benefits a lot of people. And when I joined Square, it really became crystal clear to me how awesome that journey was. When I started at Square, we were maybe 50 people. When I left Square, it was closer to 550 to 600. And I still remember the first day we did over $100,000 in payments, which at this point, I think at Square, maybe that happens every few minutes. And that journey was just incredible. So anyway, right around the time when I was at Prismatic, Keith, again, who was the CEO of Square, he had left Square at that point. And he reconnected me with Eric, the co-founder, my co-founder and CEO. And when I heard about the vision behind Opendoor from Eric, I just fell in love. Because it really felt that what Opendoor was trying to do is to extend the ideas that finance and technology have been laying the foundations of for years and years and years, and extending those ideas to the single largest transaction in people's lives. If you think about Stripe and PayPal and Square and eBay, it's really about democratizing payments, right? And enabling people to participate more in the economy. And what Open Door is trying to do is to make it way easier for people to buy and sell and over time live in a home. And it's really extending those ideas around, hey, if you can reduce the friction of that transaction, more people will be able to access that. And so if you can really reduce the friction of buying and selling a home, how might we create more financial freedom and more geographical mobility for people all across this country? And so that was a really exciting premise, and we've been at it for almost 7 years at this point.
I know. So 7 years, how big was the engineering team when you started? Was it you? Like, what did it look like day one?
It was just me. It was just me on day one, yeah.
And then today, to get an idea, what's the ballpark scale of like product engineering, test, that kind of org?
Yeah, so engineering, data science, product and design, collectively, we are about 180 today. If you isolate to engine data science, it's about 130 to 140.
Nice. So that's quite a journey, right? You're going through a few breaking points there. You know, there's like that first breaking point around 15 people when you realize that probably some of them should report to someone other than you.
Yeah.
And then there's the point where you're like 50 or 60 people and it's like it doesn't feel, you know, you need teams of teams and directors. So what was the journey like, given that you hadn't had a background being a CTO or VP and elsewhere? How did you go from one to 180? And how did you learn the things you needed to make that work?
It was very challenging, I'll be honest. definitely burned my fingers many times, and in many ways still early in the journey and still learning a lot. But I will say a couple of things helped a lot. Obviously, there's a great amount of literature. I mean, the podcasts that you do, Peter, and there are just a ton of resources out there these days where if you're an aspiring manager, you owe it to yourself to familiarize yourself with that content. Again, like podcasts, books, blog posts, there's a ton of resources out there. Another thing that I found really helpful was getting advisors early on. And so I reached out to my manager when I interned at Facebook. And I asked him, hey, would you be an advisor for us? Because I need to know I need to figure out this management thing. and my co-founder, Eric, was always, and I were always humble enough to know that we have a lot to learn. But know that actually there are a lot of folks out there that are eager to also mentor. And so finding advisors were really, really helpful. But honestly, I think there were some really tough lessons along the way. Like you mentioned, when you first reach about 10 people, when you realize, okay, you really cannot be in everything and in all meetings, how do you promote that first engineer who at that time we're all peers? There's this feeling of we're all kind of the same software engineer and we're all just kind of going after this ambitious goal. Okay, now you're introducing hierarchy. Okay, well, that's a little tricky. Now, the next phase is, okay, now you have multiple teams. And those multiple teams don't really know what the other teams are doing. And so silos start to form. And if you don't manage that carefully, you could have mistrust. So how do you make sure you're breaking down silos and encouraging people to cross-pollinate ideas and have these? And then at 50 people, you really, really, really have to start paying attention to culture. You almost have to treat that as a first-class citizen. You have to treat that as a first-class citizen because all the organic informal processes that you can rely on when you're just 15, 20 people break down when you're at 50. And you have to be very intentional about when you do all hands, when you do show and tells, when you do retros, who you invite to retros. Now that we're 130, 140 in engine data science, and especially in this remote world, I mean, that just kicks up the difficulty level to a whole different notch.
Did you get much help from the people you hired? So I was speaking with the recent interview and the person was really straightforward. They're like, you know what? I had no idea what I was doing. So I hired somebody who'd done it before. Did that help bringing in managers, directors, or VPNs, something like that with previous experience in the Valley?
Absolutely. My first job, first and foremost, is being the co-founder of the company. And not the CTO. I always view my responsibility is primarily to help the company win. And the CTO is helpful in that it gives me, frankly, just a public currency to do a lot of things that would be helpful for the business. And so one of the best uses of that currency is to be able to recruit VPs who can really help us win. So absolutely, especially as a first-time founder, as a co-founder, as a first-time manager, when I first started the company, I was trying to figure out as I go, and that's, to be honest, like not fair to the business and not fair to a lot of the folks who report to me and, you know, could grow much faster under the guidance of someone much more experienced or, you know, much more aware of management best practices. So I think it's been really helpful for us to bring on external VPs. And the VPE search, it's in itself a very, very deep topic. I must have interviewed at this point, gosh, like 60 VPEs or so over the course of the last 6-7 years. I have had conversations, at least informally, with so many VPEs. And it's really hard to actually find one that really meshes with your culture and what you need to do in your company over the next 12 to 18 months. But we've been very lucky in being able to hire Mark Kinsella just a few months ago to join as our VPE. He was formerly the director of engineering at Lyft.
Nice. And that's perfect too, because there's a strong data component at Lyft as well as at Opendoor. So, because I'd imagine one of the biggest challenges would be traditional software VP engines wouldn't necessarily find it as easy to connect with a culture that's so focused on data and data science.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of elements that make, I think, this new wave of technology companies very interesting. And by the new wave, I mean, maybe the companies that have been started in the last, call it 5 to 7 or 8 years. So you've got the Uber, Lyft, DoorDash, Instacart, maybe you can count Airbnb in there, but they're at this point, I think they're maybe 10 years old, Opendoor and so forth. I think what really distinguishes these types of companies is that they're moving lower in the societal stack, if you will, right? If you think about the ways of technology companies in the 90s and early 2000s, they were mostly purely digital. We're talking about Facebook, Google. Obviously, you have some exceptions in there like eBay and PayPal, but by and large, they were very consumer internet oriented. But over the last 5 to 7 years, to use Mark Andreessen's term, software is eating the world, it's really even not just a top layer where things could be purely digital, but I've started to really get into a layer where there's physical logistics at scale that you have to navigate. And I think that requires a different mindset as an engineering leader. And the types of VPE that do well in these environments are folks that are from Uber and Lyft, or from Instacart rather, and DoorDash, right? Folks that really understand, hey, what I'm trying to do is not pure software. In fact, actually a big part of the product, it's figuring out how all the atoms on the ground move, not just bits in the cloud, how we can enable an operator on the ground to support our customer in the best way possible. And then how do we, like you mentioned, Peter, leverage all that data and data science to make the supply chain to make efficient, to make the product seamless and delightful for the customer. So there's definitely a difference in mindset for some of these companies.
And now some exclusive offers from our partners. Amazon Web Services offers a broad set of global cloud-based products to equip technology leaders to build better and more powerful solutions. Partnering with CTO Connection, AWS is now offering an exclusive program to our listeners. The program includes up to $100,000 of AWS credits, a free consulting session with an AWS solution architect to review your environment, your strategies, and optimize your costs, and other resources to help you to get started on migrating to AWS. If you're interested in learning more, please reach out to aws-cto-program@amazon.com. To lend a hand to those ramping up remote engineering processes, CodeClimate is offering the CTO Connection community 45 days of full access to their engineering analytics application, no strings attached. Velocity turns SCM data into actionable insights so leaders can get visibility into the speed, capacity, and output of their newly distributed teams. Your 45-day package will include access to the full capabilities of the Velocity Professional package, a consultation with a product specialist who will map your key initiatives to data, and a training session for engineering managers and executives about how to interpret and apply this data in a way that engenders trust. CodeClimate hopes that this will equip engineering leadership to take on a new set of challenges in the weeks ahead. To request access, head to codeclimate.com/CTOConnection and use the code CTO connection. Now, I know something you mentioned a little earlier. I wanted to come back to, obviously, things, as you mentioned, are a little more interesting with COVID. Were you remote first before this? And what was the transition like for you and your team?
Yeah, so we are based in three locations in engineering. We've got SF, we've got Burbank in LA, and then we have Atlanta. So we've had to figure out how to run autonomous engineering offices before COVID. But certainly with COVID, everybody's plunged into this remote first reality. So we, in many ways, have had to develop a lot of new processes to make ourselves efficient and sane in this world.
Now, just to ask, so when you were just three engineering offices, but like people turned up at an office and sat down around a lunch counter together and things like that, how did you handle distributed? Was it primarily that you had teams in each location with like running different pieces of the software, or did you have any teams that were spread across two or three locations?
No, we try to make each eng office have their own mandate. So along the theme of loosely coupled but tightly aligned, we wanted folks to have a North Star as to, hey, this is what the company is going for. But hey, Atlanta, because you're co-located with our field operations team, your mandate is to make our homes unit as efficient as possible. Hey, Burbank, Burbank actually came through an acquisition, but they were very focused on our buyer products. So your goal is to make a product that buyers will love. And SF is the rest, right? So that's the seller experience, the pricing, and data science capabilities, as well as infrastructure. So that's kind of how we divided the mandates of the different locations.
Now, pre-COVID, did you have any remote engineering staff? Was it an occasional person here or there? Was it 20%? Or was it like, if you can't make it to the office every day, you're just not a fit?
We were based in hubs. And so it was very much an office culture. Now, I think we were pretty good about, for instance, work from home Wednesdays, or you know, pretty good about, hey, in Atlanta, the commute could be terrible. So I think we were much more amenable to folks working from home here and there, but there was no remote first engineer. And so we've definitely had to adjust a lot of processes to make this work for us in this time.
And now that you've done that, how are you feeling? Obviously, at some point, the world's going to reopen. We're not quite sure, you know, hey, it's going to be in the spring. We just don't know which spring, right? So at some point in time, it's going to go back. How is this fundamental, given that you're probably not going to have a lot of people in offices for at least another few months, how has this changed the culture? Do you think you're going to consider, if you get a great data scientist in South Dakota or in, you know, West Texas, are you looking to make remote first a differentiator, or is this really just something that you've just got to muddle through until you can get back to the break room?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm sure a lot of people are thinking through this right now. For us, we believe now that we've run remote first for five or six months at this point, that we really, really like it. We absolutely think it's the future. Now, having said that, what's been very difficult with COVID is that we can't bring people physically together, right? So even in a remote first world, you would still have at least, you know, half a year-ish kind of meeting where you bring people in the same location. So that's been very difficult, but I've personally been very excited by our move to remote work. I think it actually enforces a lot of discipline in how you communicate, especially with written communication. There's a lot less loose thinking, a lot less loose communication, and every meeting and every form of communication becomes more intentional, which I think is helpful. Again, you lose on a serendipity. You lose on the casual, you know, water cooler conversations and people getting lunch in the lunchroom and the connections that you can form there. But by and large, for a large set of people, I think it's actually worked out very well. So our strategy will be, hey, we'll have a remote first set of teams when COVID subsides, but we'll still have the hubs, you know, after all said and done.
Okay, so but do you think it would be a hard requirement that somebody could get into the hub like 3 days a week, or do you think that you would start to see people in a broader range of geographies?
I think we'll absolutely see folks who are working at Open Door from a broader range of geographies. Now, I think what we still have to figure out it really depends on the timeline because no one really knows how long this is going to last,
right,
is around the teams. Again, I think it's important for teams to have a mandate so that they can be autonomous and that they don't need to be coupled to, say, the headquarters, to the mothership, to be productive. I think that would be terrible for everybody. And so the question becomes, for the teams, I believe they need to be either full remote or in office. I think mixed mode is very difficult. So for the full remote teams, what are the right set of mandates for these teams, you know, given the context of our business? But that's the vision or the world that we're moving towards.
And I think that makes a lot of sense because I've had the experience of being like the one remote person, and no matter how good the company and the team, and it was a great company and a great team, it's just, I was once asked by the COO of a company I was working at, how can we fix the challenges we're currently dealing with remote? And I said, it's very, very easy. You've got three co-founders and they're the three executives, send each one to a different state, don't allow them to come back for 6 months, and all the other stuff will just magically go away. Like all the problems with conference rooms and internet access and forgetting to dial people in and all that. It just goes, just get rid of, just don't allow the founders to come into the office for a while. But I think you're right. This whole kind of mixed mode thing is much, much more difficult if you're the one remote engineer.
Yeah, totally. So I'm excited by this because I think we have gotten to be comfortable with everybody dialing in, looking at a Google Doc or something like that and jamming on that. So we've developed a lot of practices that I think will carry with us well in the future. And it's not just these meetings that it's important where you learn how to communicate well. It's also how do you create a two-way dialogue with your remote employees and making sure that you're intentional, we are intentional about hearing how people are feeling. So some of the things that we've done with COVID is up our all hands frequency from monthly to biweekly. We've done things like show and tells in engineering that are more frequent than before. I start writing, it's actually been a really good forcing mechanism for me personally. I've started every Friday to write what I call a Friday FYI to my teams, just to share what's top of mind for me, because people have stated that, hey, they don't feel as connected to me and to other leaders in the company. So we've definitely have to step up our game. And the last thing I'll say, I started creating these tea times every week where I just log on to a Zoom and whoever wants to hang out can hang out and we just chat about whatever's top of mind. And some of these things, I think, help with still creating that culture of openness that we really want, despite, you know, the fact that we can't physically meet today.
Absolutely. Well, a couple of the things we used to do is we would have every other week for the teams. I was building out a remote first org, and we would get each team together for basically an hour every other week. And they had to come up with something fun to do that had nothing to do with work. Sometimes it was Disney trivia. Sometimes it's keep talking and nobody explodes, but some kind of online game. But whatever it was something that the team co-created. And we just got to engage in a non-work setting. And then the other thing we'd do is we'd have a Zoom room that was just always open as a water cooler. And somebody would be in Slack like, I'm dropping into the water cooler. So sometimes people would literally just have a video with somebody else playing without them necessarily even talking to each other while they just both coded away. But there was that sense that you were connected to something bigger than just yourself.
Totally. That's so important these days.
So one thing that is really interesting to me is, especially with your kind of background in statistics, passion for data science, I feel like just as software is eating the world, I almost feel like data science is eating software now, right? It's like right now I would not be in a huge rush to invest in a company that didn't have a good software story, because I think they're going to eventually be replaced by a company that does have a good software story in that industry. And we're seeing that happening. But now I feel like there's a lot of CTOs who are like, yeah, we got this software thing down. That's easy. But, you know, now we have these data scientists and we don't understand them and they're strange. And a bunch of them are grad students who don't really care about real world problems, it seems. And how would you advise a CTO of a software company who doesn't have a data science background to start thinking about data science in terms of disrupting themselves and improving their capabilities?
Yeah, I think that's a really, really great question, Peter, and something that I spend a lot of time thinking about, because I believe the heart of your question is, why is data science strategic to your business? So I think you have to start from the highest order bit for the company, for the business, and then work backwards. So let me give you an example from Opendoor. What we're trying to do is make buying and selling 100 times easier for people. And so the way we do that for sellers is, hey, as opposed to listing your home and going through the emotional roller coaster of listing a home and just the 6 to 9 day process where 1 in 7 chance you can't find a buyer, you're paying a hefty fee, and you need to sell your home in order for you to move to your next home. You can just come to Open Door, request an offer, and we can give one to you in 24 hours. It's all cashed, it's our money at Open Door, and you can accept that and pick your move out date. And we've done a lot more with Home Reserve now, where we allow you to, we'll buy your next home for you all cash, we'll list your current home, and we'll transfer ownership when we sell your current home. And we've done a lot more on the buyer side as well to make it super easy for you to buy and shop and close on a home. But I can talk about all these different product features, but really what underlies the entire business is the fact that we can value homes at scale so accurately that we're willing to put our money behind it, right? So it really becomes, how do we develop the pricing, risk, and valuation capabilities for us to unlock this entire business? And then over time, if you start to have that as a starting point, you start to realize, hey, how do I construct the business in a way that I'm constantly feeding data and intelligence back into how we price, how we value? And then over time, that then creates other moats, like how do we optimize our supply chain? How do we really optimize and re-engage customers on a personalized level? And so the data science set of key questions expand. And so going back to your original question, Peter, it's really about, okay, for your business, like how can data science 10x, 100x enterprise value? And so again, for us, it started with pricing, but again, now it's really branched out to many, many different areas in the business. When you start that way, then you realize, hey, it's not just that I have to hire these rando grad students to improve on algorithms. In fact, that's almost surely the wrong thing to do, and I can explain why. But it's about, hey, how do I think about the data moat that we're creating? How do I think about where actually algorithmic sophistication actually provides differentiation for the business? And also, is it purely algorithmic, right? Actually, at Open Door and previously where I was at Square, a lot of times you're developing human-in-the-loop systems. So it's not just data science. It's actually the combination of data science, engineering, and operations that really give you that secret sauce behind really being able to take that business to the next level. So those are some of the things to unpack.
And to be super clear, when you have also humans in the loop, presumably the goal is in a perfect world for that to also be a training function going back into the model to improve. So theoretically, over time, you might require less humans per unit of work done.
Yeah, totally. And I'll give you an example from Square, and I will tell you how it translates over to Open Door as well. So at Square, one of the interesting things was fraud is always dynamic, right? As soon as one fraud vector is solved, you see new fraud vectors. So this human in the loop is very helpful in that you do all the work that is commodity, and you outsource that to the machines. And then a human gets to work on the more interesting new cases. It's the exact same thing at Open Door with housing. We are constantly looking to expand the number of homes we can value accurately. We're always looking to actually do all the things that a machine can do better and just let machines do that. And what I mean by that is counting. What I mean by that is teasing apart the relationships between thousands, if not millions, of variables and coming with an accurate valuation. So what machines are able to do is to count at scale consistently, tirelessly. What humans are great at is observing anomalies. It's observing things that become very difficult for machines to just grok. So for instance, we spend a lot of energy actually developing computer vision algorithms and geospatial algorithms to tell, hey, is there a power line cutting across your backyard? Or what's the condition of your countertop? Or what's the condition of your flooring? But we also spend a lot of energy getting the details right when it comes to data. So one of the things that we focus on are our inspection apps. It sounds trivial, but we had to get down to the level of, hey, this is the Open Door app for our inspectors to use when they go and inspect a home. And that set of questions actually is personalized / customized per home. Because we know that, hey, for certain housing types, hey, these are the things that are gotchas for the algorithms, right? That are really hard to tell. So for instance, in Dallas, because of the climate and the weather conditions in Dallas, oftentimes they have a lot of foundation issues in homes. So we pay extra attention to foundation issues, which is otherwise very difficult for an algorithm to tell, right? So, you know, it's really through this human machine hybrid where you're asking the humans to do really specialized tasks and things that humans are good at, and you augment that data set into the algorithms, that's when you can really get the magic.
Nice. And then to get an idea, just to get super tactical around the kind of setup you have, how did you first start off? Did you have like a handful of data scientists? At what point in time were you like, we should have a data engineering team? At what point were you like, we need a platform to like, you know, manage the data lakes, stuff like that? How did you think about that progression and what and who to hire first?
Yeah, I think early data science team construction is very challenging because in the early team, I really have to look for generalists. And I think that it's often very difficult with a new field like data science, where by generalist, I mean someone who can do both the algorithm side, can also do the analytics side, and also some of the engineering aspects as well. Because when you hire too many specialists too early on, then you actually need to support the specialists, and you don't have the resources to support the specialists. But as a company matures, you do need specialists to take our algorithm to the next level for us. At this point, we need people who know deep learning very well. And that is a more specialized skill set. But now we have a platform team that can enable that. So early on, it's very important from my perspective to hire folks that are just really strong, to abuse an analogy, a strong athlete. Someone who can pick a lot of things up very quickly, someone who's a generalist and are good at multiple things. And again, later on, you can afford to have some of the more specialist roles.
And how have you thought about balancing? So, I mean, some of the common career paths, I'm sure you might have some others. You've got the traditional PhD in a quantitative field, rich in statistics. You've got the software engineer who's bored and bets they can pick up this deep learning stuff. You've got the bootcamp grad who's maybe come through a data science bootcamp without necessarily a heavy duty academic background before that. How do you think about balancing those various kinds of data science practitioners?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I've seen success with all three, actually. I think there are dangers with all three. So for instance, if you're a software engineer who thinks you know data science, but if you don't really know data science, you can do the stats wrong, and that's dangerous. If you're an academic, you can be overly academic. And actually, a lot of times in business, you just need to make a decision. And that you can get into analysis paralysis and overthinking things. And that's almost like the most dangerous thing you can get into, especially as a startup. It oftentimes is better just to launch something and see from live data, right, than to over-hypothesize. And the third one is kind of the bootcamp grads, where maybe similar to academics, you might not have industry experience, and so you might not know what it means to make a decision and go with it or convince stakeholders and all that sort of stuff. But the reality is there are also strengths in all three of these backgrounds. You need the software skills. You need someone who can think very deeply. And you need folks that are just so eager to learn that they're willing to put themselves through a bootcamp to, you know, to go into this industry. And so the question becomes, how do you magnify the strengths and kind of shock absorb the weaknesses? So in the interview process on onboarding, it's very important for you, I think, for us at least, to establish the cultural values of what it means to be a successful data scientist at Open Door, right? You have to be, you know, focused on making an impact. Your job is not necessarily to, you know, be in an ivory tower and theorize. It's actually to drive, for us, very clear P&L outcomes when it comes to the pricing models. Your job, for instance, is to collaborate with stakeholders and support your teammates. These are not necessarily things that are obvious. You can't lean on a lot of the informal education to happen, say, in academia, because a lot of times, actually, academia is very weird environment. You really have to be intentional about the qualities that you want on the team.
Makes a lot of sense. And then I guess the last thing to wrap it up, how do you handle managing stakeholder expectations? Obviously, it's a little easier being a co-founder, but still, you know, the challenge with the data science is you go spend 3 months and we proved the null hypothesis. Yeah. There was no value at all in that. Like, how do you mitigate the risk of that, but also like set expectations that data science isn't magic and that, no, if we add deep learning, that doesn't guarantee that it's going to be better?
Yeah, totally. I think just sprinkle deep learning and everything's good, right? But
At least for Investor Decks.
yeah, that's right. So one of the insights I've gathered over the years is that data science is very much like design. So when you think about creating a consumer app, you can actually argue the same thing. How do I know that if I just hire a bunch of engineers and the engineers say, "Oh, let me do X for 6 to 9 months," that if it's good or bad. Certainly, if a software engineer were to come to you, Peter, and say, "Hey, give me a year, three engineers, I'll deliver something great," you'd be like, wait a
No.
second. It's the same thing, right? So in consumer products, a lot of times you actually start with UX researchers. What are the questions? What are the consumer pain points? Then you might actually have a design team that's doing early prototyping, maybe with like a few engineers, and you're trying to really quickly prove, hey, does this idea have legs? Right? Like, hey, of the set of customer pain points we're trying to address, do these prototypes or do these solutions at a lo-fi level answer these questions? It's the same thing with data science. Hey, what are the areas where we have the biggest misses in accuracy of our algorithm? Okay, what is the cheapest way for us to validate that this direction is worth going in? And then only after that do you graduate that to a full-blown team on a full-blown quarter-long kind of build-out of an algorithm or a feature or what have you? So in many ways, one of the things I've been most pleasantly surprised is actually the parallels between design and parts of data science. And to leverage product and design thinking as you build out data science algorithms and capabilities.
Nice. And I'm sorry, I'm going to have to ask one final follow-up, which is if you were a CTO or if you're advising a CTO, they've got some kind of company, there is a tech team, and they're thinking about this whole data science thing. Any recommendations on the questions, what they should look for in their first data scientist, or some of the questions they should ask to elicit competence?
Yeah, I think there are generally maybe two camps of questions you want to ask. And it depends on, again, what you're looking for in data science for a company. I would say there's camp one, which is business intelligence. A lot of times when people tell me they want data science, actually what they need is a very capable analytics team. And that's perfectly okay. Let's just be honest with that and let's ask for those capabilities there. And then secondly, it's the algorithmic part. But regardless, depending on two, now the set of competency questions might be different. On the first camp, you might be asking for how do you build certain self-service analytics. In the second camp, you might want to ask about how you built certain algorithms. But the most important thing is how do you deliver business impact? So the question that is most important for data scientists, I believe, is to ask a set of questions to make sure they understand how their work will translate to driving something for the business. So for the BI side, hey, how has your analytics driven measurable impact for your business in the past? Or for algorithms, how do you know that your algorithms are actually optimizing for something in the business? Because if you don't actually create that connection between the business and the output of the work, then you can test all the competencies you want, but they're not actually going to ladder up to what you want at the end of the day.
That's great. Ian, thank you so much for taking the time to talk today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Peter.
This episode was produced by the amazing team over at Dante 32, a podcast production agency focusing on content strategy, audio production, and distribution. Check them out at dante32.com. And if you'd like to receive new episodes as they're published, please subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you enjoyed this episode, please consider leaving a review in Apple Podcasts. It really helps others to find the show. Thank you.